All right, everybody, welcome to the January 27th edition of Cascadian Views. I'm here with Dan. JJ is out, although you will hear from him later. How are you doing, Dan?
Doing all right, Brock. How are you?
I'm doing okay. We're going to have a shorter episode length this week to accommodate an interview all three of us did. That's why I mentioned you'll hear JJ in a moment. We had the opportunity to speak to David Gerard, author of Attack of the 50-foot Blockchain, Bitcoin, Blockchain, Ethereum, and Smart Contracts, a wonderful book. We specifically talked quite a bit about the environmental impacts of Bitcoin and the electricity use. I would appreciate if everybody would hang around after the episode to listen to that. Runs about 20 minutes, and I think you'll be fairly entertained.
Yeah, I had no idea that it was such a libertarian monstrosity at pretty much every level. So stick around.
Very enlightening. As far as the news this week, we reported last week on the shutdown that was at that point a day old. It ended up lasting 3 days, at which point there was a short term 2.5 weeks. I've been rounding that down to 2 weeks, but every news media out there seems to round that up to 3 weeks, so I guess I'll just go with them. 3 week continuing resolution just to keep funding in place. It does go above and beyond in some areas. The carrot that was dangled out for Democrats was 6 years of CHIP funding. It's odd that that was a carrot dangled out for Democrats. That was one of the few bipartisan programs that Congress has. Enjoyed wide support from both sides, so the fact that the Republicans felt the need to take that hostage is enlightening, I guess I'll say. The negotiations went apparently poorly, although that seems to be mostly Trump's fault. Chuck Schumer is getting raked over the coals by a number of sides of the party, but I have the feeling that if his negotiation had actually gone through, he would have been raked over pretty harder, pretty drastically harder. The word out there was that he was offering Trump north of $2 billion for preliminary study and implementation of the border wall. This goes above and beyond Trump's demand for a $1.5 billion down payment. And he would have brought us the Dreamers back and would have funded CHIP and all that. Just hypothetically, before we get into the nuts and bolts of what actually happened on the ground, because I know we have a bit of a different take, would you have been more upset if Schumer had worked that deal?
Wow, $2 billion. I think in this grand scheme of things, in terms of actual human cost, I feel like I would have been happier with that. Yeah, I realize the wall is a stupid thing. It's an obscene waste, and every dollar we put toward it is something that will be better spent on literally anything else. At the same time, though, I mean, a lot of that can be unwound. I mean, it's not like it's something that they can go out and spend it right away. It takes time. You know, that was
you're also not building the entire wall for $2 billion. Right. It's really just basically planning.
It's a start. Exactly. Yeah. So a lot of that can be undone later. So I think if an actual fix had come through and it had protected the Dreamers, I feel like I would have had less criticism for Schumer if he'd actually managed to pull it off. As it was, yeah, I think I'd prefer that hypothetical to the reality that we got.
The reality that we got was, like I said, CHIP funding for 6 years, and everything happens again in 3 weeks.
Right. I mean, everything else is basically still on the table. You know, it needs to be pointed out again and again that both DACA and CHIP are only issues at this in the first place due to the malevolence and neglect of Republicans in Congress and Trump. You know, they ignored CHIP while they were focusing on tax cuts and their ACA repeal. And Trump actively necessitated the crisis with DACA by issuing the executive order, rolling it back. So, I mean, they, you know, the hostages are there, and I think the weakness of the Democrats' position right now is they're the only ones who seem to really care about them. You got a handful of Republican moderates, but you know, I'm worried that there's just no deal that's going to be possible with Republicans on DACA. I mean, we got chipped through, thank goodness, but you've got to get a majority of a majority in the House to sign on with this. And, you know, they're happy to shut down the government any old time. You know, we do it now. They have a little bit more responsibility, but they don't really seem to care. And they've got this nativist base that's dead set against any people coming to this country, even the most sympathetic subset of immigrants that you can think of.
Now, it's interesting that you said a majority of the majority. There was a time for a few years the Republicans seemed, if not happy, at least okay with jettisoning the Hastert rule, majority to majority requirement. We got quite a few things done under Boehner through that. Mm-hmm. Do you feel there's no way that Ryan is able to navigate around that speed bump? I mean,
not unless he's serious about this talk about him retiring. You know, Boehner got all that stuff through, but that was mostly, you know, for the most part, after he had said that, you know, he was done, he was resigning, and he wasn't worried about what House Republicans did with him because he was quitting anyway. If Ryan has any interest in, you know, continuing to be a leader of the party, abandoning the Hastert rule is going to be the end of him. So I think, yeah, as long as that's the case, you know, somehow you have to make a majority of House Republicans think it's going to hurt them to not continue DACA, or, you know, to come up with a fix for it. And that's really hard to come up with. You know, I can't think of anything they care about enough that could get them to do it.
I think if you see the gerrymandered decisions come down the way that we're hoping they do, you might see that change pretty quick. There's been some kind of movement on that in the state level. I think it was Pennsylvania has been required to redraw their maps by their state Supreme Court. They got a special master put in place, which is a Stanford professor who had previously worked with other states doing the same thing.
Right.
That gerrymandering advantage they have, where they don't really have to listen to concerns of minority voters, that is really, I think, the one thing that has to change in order for them to start taking this shit seriously. As long as they can draw their districts to, you know, cut up their aging block of, you know, white-haired old rich people into thin chunks that win them elections, while packing certain districts full of those minorities that they don't want to have to talk to, we're not going to see anything.
Right. I mean, that's really the dynamic right now. Is we've got a geographic distribution that's bad enough. You know, it's, you know, most Democratic leading voters are going to be living in, you know, compressed areas, urban areas, cities. So you combine that with actively distorting gerrymandering efforts, and yeah, you get Democrats that are winning their races by 90-some%, but then, you know, 7 out of 10 districts will be, you know, 55-60% Republican because of the way they've distributed it. And even though you could have a statewide vote, you know, that might be, you know, a little better than half for Democrats, you know, you'll have a supermajority of representatives coming out that are Republicans. So yeah, there's a lot of these cases coming to the Supreme Court. The Pennsylvania one you mentioned, that was kind of my thing to watch this week. That is notable because that actually is a case that was decided on the basis of the Pennsylvania Constitution. So presumably the Supreme Court can't get their hands on it. So that one may be a really decisive factor, actually, in how the elections go this fall, because that could free up, you know, probably, I think they were estimating upwards of a half a dozen seats for Democrats in Pennsylvania that right now they're being shut out of due to these partisanly designed maps.
Pennsylvania had for years some of the worst gerrymandered districts in the country. Democrats, up until this last election, would routinely carry the state, not by huge margins, but comfortable margins. And yet the Republicans would walk away with like a two-thirds or three-quarters majority of the congressional delegation.
Yeah, the last round of gerrymandering in particular there, which was after was it not Snyder? It was one of the other really terrible governors that was elected that year, was elected in Pennsylvania, and so they had trifecta governance, and they just rammed it through there. And Ohio, and I think Wisconsin were some of the absolute worst.
All right. We've got 2.5 Trump stories this week. So I'm going to start with the one that's probably the lighter fare of the 2.5 here. The Air Force One, which is a bit of a boondoggle. We've been working on upgrading this for, God, 15 years now. It's supposed to be entirely new jets at some point, but we still have to keep the current one functioning, which is getting to be, I think, like 30 years old. But we just signed a contract with Boeing to replace two of the five refrigerators on Air Force One, and it is going to cost the US taxpayer nearly $24 million. Normally, I would not really bother with a type of story like this. It's on Air Force One. There's probably some special things about these refrigerators. I'm not going to doubt that.
They've got a drawer that keeps a Big Mac
Yeah.
at an optimal temperature of 55 degrees. Ugh.
That $24 million is still high, no matter what the fuck is special about these refrigerators. But also, this used to be one of Trump's favorite things to rip on President Obama about. He used to basically probably pay somebody to go through the US budget and find ridiculous shit and then tweet about it at the president. This is exactly that. There is this huge, like, I don't know, amusing contrast between the old Trump and the new Trump that's so shameless and not even a little bit hidden that it makes me wonder if it's all real. It really does.
I was gonna say, didn't he start off early in the term talking about how he was gonna shake down Boeing and maybe he was gonna get some other manufacturer to make them or something like that? He was claiming that the new Air Force Ones were gonna be such a ripoff, and
You
yeah,
know
here we
what?
are.
If somebody is going to be ripping off Trump, it might as well be a good Pacific Northwest company like Boeing. Might as well be getting that moolah over here. But doesn't he have like a jumbo jet made of solid gold? Why is he even flying in this thing? He thinks the White House is a dump and spends most of his time at Mar-a-Lago. Why doesn't he just stick Air Force One in the fucking garage and fly his other plane? He was already charging the US government for it.
Yeah, well, I gotta imagine Air Force One is more secure and probably better. You know, he's
It is a 30-year-old 747.
fair enough, fair enough.
Like, it's got some upgrades. I think even beyond what we don't know, I think it's confirmed that it's got like chafe launchers and electronic countermeasures. And yeah, there's been some upgrades to it, but at its core, it's a 30-year-old airframe. Like, this is the fruits of 1970s technology.
Yeah. So yeah, he's presumably got his gold-plated shitter and everything. Wouldn't he be more comfortable that way, you'd think? Oh well.
I know I'm not happy if I'm not pooping on gold.
It's also
To
the best surface for crunching up an Adderall and snorting in at 4 a.m.
Oh man. It will have 70 cubic feet of storage space between the two refrigerators. So that's almost 500,000 per cubic foot.
I'm pretty sure I could find a better deal at the Home Depot.
Yeah.
Sears, whichever.
If Air Force One is already trash, we might as well just run some extension cords and have a Costco chest freezer in that bitch.
God. We gotta right. laugh, because...
yeah, the next one's pretty bad. There's been a lot of revelations in the Mueller-Trump relationship. The New York Times broke the story that Trump had fired Mueller, or attempted to fire Mueller, at least ordered the firing of Mueller, back in June. And his own White House counsel, McGahn, threatened to resign if that order were carried out, and that apparently choked Trump off from that. The fact that he made the attempt, though, I think shows we weren't that off base with the bills that Republicans refused to consider that would have protected Mueller from Trump firing him.
Right, and apparently it's been only blatant insubordination by his underlings that's keeping him from going into this kind of insane lawlessness. That's not a good situation either.
Dan, you want to shit your pants?
Yeah, sure. Go for it.
The biggest constitutional crisis in probably the history of democracy hinges solely on the ethical and personal moral compass of Mr. McGahn.
Someone who would work for Trump in the first place.
Seriously.
That's just great. You know, we're doing fine.
He's also apparently talking openly with aides about firing Rosenstein out of the Department of Justice there, who is in charge, at least theoretically, of the independent counsel's investigation, owing to the fact that Attorney General Jeff Sessions has recused himself from that, seeing as how he was involved in the thing.
Right, and that would be basically the key to firing Mueller again, since that's the person who would have to decide there was some kind of misconduct to proceed with the orders of the Orange Emperor. And great, that's good, that's really good. With these impulses in mind, because yeah, McGahn wouldn't be the one that would fire Mueller. It would have to be Rosenstein.
No, but McGahn would have to defend Trump's actions as legal.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I feel comfortable, and it's also great that we're still seeing no traction on the Mueller protection bills. That's also comforting.
So something that I thought was interesting was when I was going through government class in high school, we always learned it as the attorney general was the people's lawyer and that the White House counsel was the president's lawyer. Mm-hmm. And in these actions where Trump has talked apparently openly among his staff about how he feels like Jeff Sessions isn't protecting him like other attorney generals have done, and McGahn's the one stepping in to, you know, put the brakes on any obviously unconstitutional action, it seems like they've got those roles kind of reversed, or at least Trump has those roles kind of reversed.
Yeah. Well, I've been starting to wonder if it's some kind of ethical quandary here and whether or not the advice that Trump is getting is really the best, because, and hear me out, all the indications that I think we are getting right now from Congress, from the people who would actually have, you know, responsibility for acting if Trump were to step over this line, were to fire Mueller, are that the most that they're going to do is complain about it a little bit. That what actually happens after that in terms of things that materially affect the president is just not going to come about. He'll get to go. If he fires Mueller, he's scot-free. He experiences a bit of political trouble and his approval rating probably goes down. It's already pretty far down. But as far as potential crimes, damage to his family, all of that goes away. So if his lawyers are telling him not to fire Mueller, not to do this, are they really acting in his best interest? Is my thought here. If he could get away with it and his lawyers are telling him, you know, don't do it, you know, and presumably increasing his jeopardy every day you know, the more that Mueller comes up with and the more he has something that he could at least pass off to Congress, yeah, I think that increases Trump's jeopardy every day that the probe continues. So, I mean, it's unethical to tell your client to do something illegal, but it's perfectly legal for him to fire Mueller. I don't know. It's a weird question for me trying to pick this one over.
I also want to kind of put the brakes on something there. It is not actually legal for him to fire Mueller, but it is legal for him to fire people until he gets somebody who will fire Mueller.
Absolutely.
He is like a step removed. He's not directly able to fire Mueller.
Right.
But so, he can order Rosenstein to, and then fire Rosenstein when he doesn't, and then talk to the next guy in charge of the Justice Department, just go down the chain until he gets somebody who will.
Right, until it's, you know, Acting Attorney General Jared Kushner, and then it's done. Yeah, he can do that. That is all within his power, and it would not break any laws to do it.
Well, I mean, that would be a whole nother obstruction charge if you're keeping track, but who would be doing that without Mueller there?
Exactly. You know, who's left to hold him accountable? But in the meantime, yeah, he's in legal jeopardy as long as the investigation is going on. So, it's weird when the president is, let's just say it, a criminal. It's bizarre.
You are a lawyer with ethical training. How would you come down on that?
Oh, geez. Well, I don't think I'd want to work for Trump, because the biggest problem is when you've got a client who is guilty and doesn't take advice and just kind of corks off at every opportunity, is you're going to get yourself into the kind of legal situation I'm describing, where to act in your client's best interest, you know, potentially exposes you to some other ethical issue, and you find yourself where there's no good option. So I guess by advising Trump to do the responsible thing, they're doing themselves okay in the interest of history. And I assume Trump is not going to sue his attorneys from prison. But I don't know. It's such a strange situation.
I focused in a little bit on your mention about how he doesn't take advice, because there's another ripple to the story that focuses kind of on that. Trump's legal team has been preparing for a request for an interview from Mueller, apparently for a couple weeks. Sessions has now been interviewed by Mueller. It's gone into the cabinet. Bannon is going to be sitting down with Mueller. Bannon actually got a subpoena from Mueller, but then agreed to a voluntary interview. It was strange. The news seemed to think that was the whole thing from the beginning. Like, even before it was confirmed that that's what happened, they were like, this could pretty easily be a tactic to get him to some leverage, get him to come in on his own. And then it turned out that that's what it is. So that made me suspicious that they might have somebody inside Mueller's team. But anyway, Trump's lawyers have been telling him not to commit to anything, not to have any opinions, say it's probably not going to happen. They were apparently aghast when Trump walked out in front of TV cameras, held an impromptu news conference, and said that he would be happy to talk under oath with Mr. Okay. Mueller.
Yeah, again, that's, you know, you're advising your client, you're trying to keep them from committing additional crimes. Trump sitting down with Mueller is probably the worst possible
under oath
you could have. Yeah, exactly.
Under oath, where lying is a crime.
Yeah, exactly. You know, that is a perjury charge. It's additional obstruction charges just waiting to happen. They're, you know, if you're representing this person, no way. No way would you let them do this if you could avoid it.
This is the Martha Stewart charge. She couldn't get busted for the tax evasion, so she got busted for lying to the FBI about the tax evasion, or SEC. Yeah. But yeah.
Or they're even talking about making it worse. You know, they had, you know, suggestions that maybe it could be hybrid testimony, where he gives something in writing and then has some other discussions in person. Can you imagine giving additional statements, probably prepared, and having Trump have to keep track of that while under questioning. Oh, dear God.
I have a fantastic story about getting busted by a ridiculous number of cop cars with a couple of my friends. And one of the key points of it is when I decide that it's easier to tell the cops the truth in order to not have to keep track of what lies I've already told them going forward in a compromised mental state.
Exactly. That's exactly it. Except with him, it's addled on, you know, Big Macs and Diet Coke.
Yeah. And
probably a lot of addled. But yeah. Oh, good God. Yeah. All right. That's one thing that if I totally took leave of my senses and were representing Trump, that's one thing I would say. It's do not, under any circumstances, talk to Mueller unless you absolutely cannot avoid it.
Yeah. In fact, at this point, Mueller could even issue a subpoena, and I'm pretty sure any reasonably advised president would just sit on it, because whether or not he can even do that is an open legal question.
Exactly. Yeah. Gosh, you know, I was too young during the Clinton years. I don't really remember, but I'm sure there must have been a fight over his participation in the testimony that he ended up giving.
Oh, there was. I'm pretty sure he did it by teleconference from the White House. His final demand was that he wasn't going to leave the fucking White House.
Right, right. So, same thing here. Under no circumstances, go without a fight. Oh, man.
Yeah, they made him interview him over CCTV.
Right, right.
All right. Poof. Let's flip to our last bit of the in this case, international news. Team Trump went to Davos. It was, in most instances, a fairly unremarkable trip. Trump got booed by the international press. What else is new? The American press actually seemed to love his appearance there. What else is new? They love flipping the script from time to time. But the real heavy thing here was Mnuchin went a couple days before the president. He went out and he spoke. He gave a speech there. He had a talk there. He was on a couple boards. And he trashed the U.S. dollar. Which is not really the job of the U.S. Secretary of the Treasury. He went out there and he said that a weak dollar is going to be good for the U.S. and good for its trade. And, you know, the dollar's been weakening for a couple of years. And that's for the best. And the dollar tanked. Depending on what you measure it against, it tanked by more than 1% when looked at compared to the yen or the euro. Compared to things like the pound or the peso, it fell a slightly smaller amount, around 0.8%. Markets seemed to settle on a 0.8% global tanking of the dollar. It was pretty impressive, I have to say. There are a few men in history who can claim to have wiped that much wealth off the face of the planet in just a single sentence. So props to you, Steve Mnuchin.
Nicely done. Yeah, we were talking about this a little bit before, and I guess it's a matter of what you can say and in what role you're in. Because again, he's, you know, from an Econ 101 perspective, he's not wrong. You know, a weaker dollar would help U.S. imports, but it's not okay for the Treasury Secretary to say that. You know, it suggests to the world and markets that the U.S. Department of the Treasury doesn't care about the relative strength of the dollar. So, yeah, sell, sell, sell.
It's amazing to me the things that Trump would attack Obama for. And Obama's defense, even at the time, but also since he's left office perhaps more directly, always just been like, I was thinking that shit, but I can't say that shit.
Right.
And it really seems to me that one of the traits that runs through Trump's team from top to bottom is that none of them know what they can and can't do. Yeah. None of them know, like, the role they're in public service is fundamentally different than what they were doing before.
As a looting corporate raider, I don't see why I can't do that now, as Secretary of Health and Social Services say. Why not?
All right. Let's flip it local for our last 10, 15 minutes or so here. We have a trio of stories. We mentioned last week that Oregon was going to the polls. Measure 101 was the major issue. This was a worked out to roughly 0.7% tax on hospitals and health insurers in order to raise between $200 and $300 million, which would allow Oregon to fund its Medicaid expansion and get matching funds, in fact, more than matching funds from the feds, to the tune of $700 million. This was a measure that is rare, I think, in kind of politics that you usually see, in that the industries that were going to be taxed were the most heavily invested in passing the measure. The single largest donor to the Yes on 101 campaign was the Association of Oregon Hospitals. That's not actually their name. I just can't remember the acronym at the moment. They contributed, I think, something like 80% of the funding to pass this new tax through. You don't see that often. They were basically saying, yes, please tax us. In return for paying $200 to $300 million more in taxes, they would be getting roughly $1 billion more in health care. It's easy to see the trade-off on that.
Right. Or if you're a crazy person, then clearly the swamp needs to be drained in Oregon. Yeah. Oh, that's great. Yeah, I was kind of following that on Tuesday night, and that was really good to see that, yeah, right call.
The results across the state have not been finalized. I believe Oregon only requires votes to be postmarked by the day that they're supposed to be in if they don't have to actually receive.
Right.
But at this point, it's pretty much a done deal. It's 61% in favor, 39% against. The counties that voted against it were surprisingly mainly rural counties in the south and the of the state. Really the Republican stronghold of the state. But other than that, yeah, Multnomah voted 80% yes. Lane County down there in Eugene voted even higher than Multnomah did in favor of it. Springfield voted in favor of it. All the population centers were behind it.
Sure.
Apparently, you can only think poor kids deserve to not die from preventable medical care if you live in a city. Who knew?
That's America. That's where we live now.
Yep. This is, surprise, surprise, a little bit up in the air, though, with the Republicans' continued attempts to dismantle Obamacare. Oregon is already getting kind of sneaky with some of its payments. We've been charging certain subsidies that we're providing to people on the exchange through an other cost reimbursement system through the Medicaid expansion. That's not hitting the White House clamp down on some of these payments that they're making. We're kind of toeing the line on this, and I am a little bit curious to see how long Trump's going to not do anything about it. He's picked on Oregon pretty specifically before, and Portland pretty specifically before, so we know we're on his radar a little bit.
Sure. Yeah. I guess was it just recently that they finally got the new HHS secretary sworn in or approved through the Senate? So, yeah, there may be more attention on that and another more political person running things. So, yeah, who knows?
There was some good old pork barrel politics in this too. In order to get this house to the Senate, we needed a single Republican vote. Democrats, I believe, are treading water in there. Don't really have the muscle to get it through. We needed one Republican, and we basically bribed the guy. He was the Republican from Medford, a district I've visited many a times and lived in Ashland briefly. But he got three projects in his district. $1 million to restore a theater in Medford, $750 for a new ballpark also in Medford, and then $1.9 million for an irrigation, a crop irrigation project also in Medford. And it's in exchange for all that, we got one Republican vote on this bill, which allowed it to go through and go out to the people as a vote. His one condition was that we put it to a statewide vote. He would give his vote in exchange for those projects and putting it on the ballot as a statewide vote.
Okay. All right. You know, not to, you know, trash on good government a little bit, but I feel that, you know, this is the kind of reason why the federal government doesn't really work anymore, because we've gotten a rid of a lot of the opportunities for lawmakers to do something like this, to back a bill they're not entirely behind for partisan reasons, because there's something that they can bring home to their constituents.
Yeah, so, a little grease makes everything move smoother.
Exactly, just a little bit of pork, you know. It's greasy stuff, but it gets what you need. You can, you know, pass a budget without the government shutting down every, you know, 18 months.
And to be honest, I'm not even, like, that opposed to any of those things. New sure. irrigation systems for farmers? Sounds great! Sign me up! Especially if it's a new system that wastes less water than whatever leaky-ass shit from the 80s they're using right now. You want to preserve a historic cedar and renovate it? That sounds great! Wonderful! You want to build some kids' new ballpark? Totally go for it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that's the key thing. I mean, if yeah, it's not ideal to have infrastructure and projects taken care of because, you know, it appeases, you know, a powerful congressperson, you know, to get this particular project done. It's not the ideal way to do it. But the alternative is this stuff doesn't get done at all. And that's so much worse. So, yeah, I bring back earmarks. Jesus.
There was some talk about them doing that, and yeah. The Republicans apparently balked. I think you might see that happen. I mean, the sharks are circling on John McCain. There's a couple Republicans, including some people in the Arpaio camp, who are all basically saying a bunch of them are angling for McCain's seat, and they don't think he's going to hold out. Right. And McCain was really the face of the no pork movement in the Republicans. And I think without his voice in the Senate, you might see things change very quickly.
Right. You know, grizzly bear DNA, all that stuff. Volcano yeah. monitoring. Yeah. All right. Well, we'll see.
Has anybody ever managed to explain to you why volcano monitoring isn't so great?
Successfully? No. I think that's something to keep an eye on, you know. But
maybe these are people who have never lived anywhere near a volcano, but we kind of would like to know when they're getting ready to explode.
Yeah, I've got one relatively nearby. I'd, you know, rather have a little bit of notice.
This city is still, like, worships the Mount St. Helens eruption and the day that ash fell all over Portland. Mm-hmm. Like, there are monuments and pictures and murals up to it in several places around.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's a pretty major thing when it happens. You yeah. want to be ready. Yeah.
All right. All Let's right. bounce up to Washington here. There is two bits of, well, I want to say good news, but maybe I'll let us decide that a little bit later. Washington, I did not know this, but had a statewide ban on affirmative action, or has, currently still has.
Yeah.
Now, I understand that it's a very controversial idea, maybe in its implementation, but I think we can all kind of agree that there's a systemic bias against certain minority groups, and working to correct that and give them the same opportunity as anybody else and not limit them because of those societal systemic repressions that they've faced, you know, through housing and schooling and all that. We would like to find a solution around that. Not everybody agrees it's affirmative action, but an outright ban on any affirmative action seems very counter to the morals of the state, I would think. So I was surprised to learn that they had that. But they are considering getting rid of it, I hear.
Yeah, well, I guess it goes to show that you can pass a lot of stuff that kind of seems to go against the ideology or general deeper thought of a state when it goes to a statewide voter initiative. But yeah, I mean, the federal framework right now on immigration, or not immigration, on affirmative action, is fairly restrictive in how some of these considerations can be used. You know, it's not like, you know, people, the image that comes to people's mind is quotas and things like that. You have to have so many of X, so many of Y. That's not how that's not a legal regime under the current federal law and the decisions that the Supreme Court has made. You know, it's often can be at most a consideration among a number of factors, especially for things like university admissions, which are always kind of the most salient ones. But there's also hiring for government jobs. So
the university ones, though, have seemed to me to be the ones that the Supreme Court is most comfortable with, even if they're not that comfortable with any of them. But they have, even in the decisions that limit how it can be used, acknowledged diversity as a good thing in an educational context.
Right, right. Then that's why they basically allow it to continue. I mean, if it were something where, you know, a university had to hire, say, so many, or not hire, but had to admit so many African Americans every year, you know, that would pass the Supreme Court's muster. The tests that they've applied have, they've decided that that's not an appropriate test and not something that they can constitutionally allow. But, you know, the more sophisticated tests where it's, you know, allowed to be a factor among a number of other considerations when looking at a candidate, that's something that's passed constitutional muster several times. I think even as recently as this last year, the Supreme Court affirmed that as a basis of consideration in university admissions.
Was that the University of Texas case?
Yes, that's what I'm thinking of.
All right. Yeah, the process here confuses me a little bit. The results, or not the results, but the cause of the affirmative action ban was a voter referendum in 1998. Is the Senate allowed to just get rid of that without doing another referendum?
I believe so. I think I'd have to look at state referendum law. I think it's the kind of thing where it takes a certain period of time before they can take contrary action in the legislature. But I don't believe it would require another referendum to reverse. It makes me think, I'm assuming it's probably similar to the Alaska referendum statutes, with which I'm a little more familiar, which I think it had a 5-year period between when something was passed by initiative and when the legislature could actively intervene and make tweaks to something that had passed in that manner.
See, California is a much more fucked up system where they can't get rid of it at all. They are allowed to tweak it in order to implement it better, because a lot of these citizen referendum are incredibly vague and need like actual legislative frameworks and whatnot. But they're kind of stuck with the intent of the referendum.
Right. Hence, you know, the fucked up property tax system.
Yeah.
Things like that. Yeah.
All right. And our last little bit of local news, in an issue that's become more prevalent since the Las Vegas massacre, bump stocks were on the agenda up in Washington, and looks like they're going to be banned from the state. The Senate passed it. I believe the House is expected to as well. And it passed comfortably in the Senate.
Yeah, actually a bipartisan majority, because it's like it's a razor thin, you know, control margin in both the House and the Senate here. So clearly they're able to get a number of Republicans on board for this. And
yeah, four.
Good for that. You know, and this is in the wake of terrible, terrible incidents like Las Vegas. This is really kind of the least that government can do to step up and change, you know, just at least one aspect of the horrible crime that was committed there, make it at least one part of it not repeatable. But yeah, so at least we can see that happening, that it's possible for some legislation to come through in some states.
Now, the Republicans who backed it, and as well as a Democrat who I guess said he wasn't going to back it until the end, were brought on board by basically some language that's more explicit about what a bump stock is, because that's important. Otherwise, when somebody creates something that works just like a bump stock and lets you do the same thing, but doesn't meet this ridiculously tight and overly, you know, minute legal definition, it's not banned, and they can go back to having their massive massacres. It's great.
Right. Yeah, it's, like, well, shoot. What? Oh, yeah, well, there you go. Yeah, I'm trying to think. There was that early episode of The West Wing where they're celebrating getting an assault weapons ban passed and realizing after it's done that, you know, with just a few changes to the patent or the makeup of the gun, you know, you can basically get the same weapon back on the street with almost no impediments whatsoever. And that's kind of, you know, the horror that we are dealing with in trying to manage, you know, what we've allowed on our streets to this point.
I cannot imagine a more common sense solution to these things than you should be required to, like, get approval to sell instead of the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'm just, you know, a pinko communist who, you know, loves getting Stalin's jat boot behind.
Yeah, you and Stalin and George the Third and yeah.
But that seems like a pretty great way to cut down on shit like this. Anyway, good on you, Dean Tacko. Good on you, Washington Republican senators, for watering down a bill that, you know, is still not horrible, but could have been a lot better, and now is very, very narrowly focused on what has already happened and not preventing what could happen in the future.
You know, the least that could be done, at least that was it. At least they did it.
Yeah. I mean, they did actively go out of their way to make it crappier, but then they voted for it. So good on you guys. Golf clap.
Exactly. And I've gotten jaded the last few years. It seems like the response to every major news horror with guns that comes across, the response is to make gun laws worse. You know, the whole idea of a good guy with a gun, just let him loose on the streets and then that'll solve it. That'll make it better. Get some crossfire going.
Yeah, make it even harder for the cops to figure out who's the bad guy.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, that was this week's episode. I hope you guys enjoyed the interview coming up after this. I'll see you next week, Dan, and we should have JJ with us as well.
Sounds great. Have a good week.
Have a good week. This has been your January 27th edition of Cascadian Views. See you later. What follows from this point, guys, is Dan, JJ, and I's interview with David Girard, author of Attack of the 50-Foot Blockchain. He was on speaking mostly about cryptocurrencies and the environmental impacts that stand behind them. If you guys enjoy the conversation we have, please check out his book. It's available on Amazon and any other fine bookseller out there. I hope you guys enjoy listening as much as I enjoyed having the conversation. I'm going to assume you have in your back pocket kind of a 30-second, 45-second overview of what Bitcoin is for those who may not be familiar with it.
Oh, God. This is the worst question in the world because you can't... Can you explain Bitcoin in 5 seconds? No.
Yeah.
Because it's complicated. I mean, holy crap. I literally wrote a book to explain it, and that I kept that down to 55,000 words, you know.
Took quite a bit of effort. Your
there's
book.
There's no answer which you can give on what is Bitcoin without sort of that. No answer that is in any way complete or useful to most people.
My favorite explanation, I think, that I've seen. It doesn't have a lot of explanatory power, except in the kind of broad brushes, but. Digital Beanie Babies was my favorite kind of derisive term for it. And I guess I'll give my best attempt to explain the nuts and bolts of it. They have computers, and they have massive farms of computers, and they attempt to solve these various complicated math problems, and then they hash the answers. And if your hash ends in all zeros, congratulations, you just created libertarian money. That seem
That's
fair?
Pretty much... Yeah, I would say Bitcoin's like digital money. It's like money in your bank account, and you can access it with a card or whatever, except that you can't use a card. You have to remember the exact numbers or get your computer to, and it's all brittle, and it doesn't work properly, and it breaks easily, and you can easily lose it and be hacked, and there's no customer service, and it doesn't accept it anywhere.
Pretty much zero use. And that zero use was... I'm sorry, go on.
It's great for speculation.
Yeah, people make a lot of money, except in the last couple of months when they lost about half of their money, from what it seems like, judging by the market numbers.
Oh, it's completely zero sum. So anyone who comes in new will almost is much more likely to lose their money because they'll be taken by the ones who've been there for ages.
I brought up these massive farms of computers because I think one of our main points with this interview, the Cascadian region has a long history with environmentalism, pushback against that sort of spoiling of nature. And one of the big problems with Bitcoin, as it's expanded from being just what people do in their basements with their spare computers to being actual big money, is it chews through electricity. And more to the point, most of the mining is happening in China, where coal is the main power source. So it's some of the dirtiest electricity you can possibly imagine. One of the links
That actually hasn't been the case for a while.
Oh, true.
A lot of it is actually surplus overbuilt hydro.
Okay.
So now there is a lot of coal. It's not all clean by any means. Because what happened in China was they overbuilt power plants in the last decade or so, like hugely overbuilt them. And the national grid wasn't properly hooked up. So you had a lot of power plants where there was literally no other use for the power. So they sold it to Bitcoin miners. And this was fine for a while. But in the last few months, a lot of power plants have been actually getting hooked up to the grid properly. And they're kicking the Bitcoin miners off. The People's Bank of China, they don't take the sort of light touch approach that the SEC does in the US. If they don't like you, they ban you, if you're lucky. They've had to actually point out to some ICO fundraisers that illegal fundraising can carry the death penalty in China because the People's Bank of China doesn't mess around.
They were just doing that as a friendly heads up, like, hey, if you guys keep going on this way, we might cut your head off.
Indeed. So, it produces a certain regulatory tone. With Bitcoin mining, their current thing is that they're refusing to provide subsidies to Bitcoin miners anymore. You can't just sell less electricity cheap to them. And they're looking into their operations very closely because spending electricity on Bitcoins is not illegal. So, but they aren't fans of it. So anyway, with the miners slowly being pushed out of China, they are looking afield to places that have surplus power capacity, typically overbuilt hydro, in fact. And I understand that some are looking around the Pacific Northwest as well. But yeah, anywhere where there's a lot of surplus power, more than the grid can easily cope with, then they're seeing if they can get their miners out of China and into those places.
Do you know by chance what the Chinese government's issue with Bitcoin miners is, aside from just this battle over power and energy and power plant usage? Is there some other
yep.
part of their contestation with miners?
They don't like Bitcoin and cryptos in general because, I mean, these things are just used for speculation. They joined in the Bitcoin and ICO and cryptocurrency craze as much as everyone else did last year. It got to the point where they actually banned cryptocurrency exchanges for exchanging money back and forth. They think this stuff is horrible, speculative garbage. It contributes nothing to the actual economy that people live in. And they're worried that it'll eventually get big enough that it'll damage the real economy when it pops.
Okay, and that's kind of where
this is
I
a
was,
bubble. It's going to
yeah,
pop.
Right. And that was kind of what I was assuming, is that the kind of the fluctuations in this market, while not anathema to silly Americans who have no problems with the boom and bust economy despite its nonsensical nature, but you know, the Chinese government, of course, is much more accustomed to having a solid central control and command structure that this kind of volatility, market volatility, I would see would be a real concern and a worry for them.
Yeah, they're, I mean, I think that personally, I hope the Bitcoin bubble sooner rather than later, because a lot of people are going to get burnt already when it pops, and the longer it goes on, the worse it'll be.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, the Bitcoin attitude sort of lol, get wrecked, grandma, but I don't think that's really a good basis to be going forward on.
Yeah, and it's starting to hit kind of ancillary industries already. We have a friend of ours in our gaming group who's having trouble finding a decent GPU because the prices are so jacked from people using it to mine.
Gamers hate them. And it is literally at the point where you will not be able to safely buy a video card from 2017 or maybe 2016 because without having to guess that you're getting a burnt out wreck from a miner. You know, they'll do anything to try to squeeze the life out of these cards because, you know, these cards aren't made for that. It turns out if you run a video card at 100% 24/7, you burn them out. If you don't want to do that, then NVIDIA sell you more robust cards for scientific computation or whatever, which Bitcoin mining is a specialist case of, you know.
Yeah, wasn't it all like the Quadra line?
Yeah, that sort of thing. I'm being general here. When I say Bitcoin mining, I mean all crypto mining in general. You can't actually mine Bitcoins directly with graphics cards anymore.
Yeah, you need like an ASIC to really get the power behind it.
Yeah, basically specialized chips that can do nothing except this one dumb computation over and over. So, I mean, Bitcoins aren't based on complicated calculations. They're based on stupidly simple calculations, calculating an SHA-256 hash, but they make it difficult because they say you have to have the right number of zeros at the front of your answer. And that's the entire cryptographic lottery.
That's kind of a debate within the crypto community itself. Proof of work versus proof of stake, if I recall.
Well, proof of stake has the one minor problem that no one's come up with a version that works yet. There's a lot of miner coins. I mean, they know that proof of work is really, really dumb. Like it was a hack. I mean, all Bitcoin is a hack. It's literally the first cardboard and string prototype that shows that such a thing as this is even possible. And it's an interesting idea. Wow, you managed to do that. I'm impressed, you know. But it's like they pressed the cardboard and string prototype into production and that never works out well. So you have the situation now where 0.1% of the world's electricity is spent mining Bitcoins. And this is really dumb. Now, I have heard the arguments that, and you can make the argument that, well, it's their money, they can spend it how they like. And in practice, that's what happens. But there's no way it isn't stupid. And crypto people do sort of know it's stupid.
And it's so, our planet. We're throwing away massive resources on something like that and then just dumping them into our atmosphere. Not in the cases of the hydropower, obviously, but still.
There are some truly amazing arguments from Bitcoin fans that actually Bitcoin mining is good for the environment because I think the argument goes that it will stimulate greater increases in power and this will stimulate more renewable forms of energy and therefore buy more Bitcoin. And I've heard more convincing arguments from junkies trying to get me to lend them money. You have never heard more self-serving arguments than from Bitcoiners deep in the throes of an ether binge. But with Ethereum are trying really hard to go for proof of stake, but they have a proof of stake FAQ, which is a page on their wiki, and it's basically a list of things they've worked out wouldn't actually work out very well. Like proof of stake is basically the more coins you have, the more you can mine. It's them's what has gets. And now you might think that there's obviously no way that you're going to make this into anything that is decentralized or that people or distributed or equitable or that people want to deal with. But yeah. So, I mean, they're slowly approaching complete centralization, walking backwards and not looking behind them. And they'll end up with a system that is basically equivalent to having a central banking or money creation system, but all stupid. Like Bitcoin's there already. The whole idea of mining was to decentralize it, and it's centralized in a whole bunch of mining, in like five mining pools in China. And because any sort of process that's susceptible to economies of scale is naturally going to centralize. So yeah.
And the centralization, these, you know, mining pools that you talk about, just they really are resource intensive. The cryptocurrency mining pool, according to DigiEconomist, exceeds the energy consumption of 159 countries. It's basically equivalent to the nation of Denmark.
And remember, none of this is needed to do the calculations.
It's
you could
worthless.
Do the calculations on a 2007 iPhone would be fast enough to actually run the numbers. The money, the whole point of Bitcoin is it literally wastes the energy to compete with other people wasting energy as a show of commitment. That's how proof of work works, because that was the only hack they could come up with to completely decentralize control, and they haven't come up with a better one, so they've gone with that one.
It's almost like Scientology. Before you can get to the top of the system, you have to commit to at least, you know, $500,000 or some shit.
Something like that. That would be more proof of, I don't know, something.
Yeah. Proof of crazy.
I mean, no one could call Bitcoin a cult. No, there's sort of no L. Ron Hubbard figure. I mean, Satoshi Nakamoto, the creator of it, Bitcoin, seems to have been a perfectly reasonable, sincere sort of geek guy. He just came up with this interesting idea that he thought was a good idea. And I don't think it was out to scam anyone or whatever. But yeah, I mean, he abandoned Bitcoin completely by about 2011 and disappeared. And his million Bitcoin stash has never moved since then.
There's been some talk that the easiest way to crash the market would be for those coins to start to move.
I think that what would actually happen is that everyone would go, this is actually going to moving. This is fine. Number go up. This is fine. Because, you know, actual trading in Bitcoin is really thin. Like, there isn't actually a lot of trading. So if another million coins were suddenly in the pool of coins that exist, well, we've already got enough large Bitcoin holders who could crash the market any time if they wanted to. So I think that what they would do is just say, this is fine. I am okay with these events, and just hope the number stayed up.
All right.
Because that's the essential Bitcoin ideology is number go up, and everything is secondary to that.
That's
the ideology.
It's becoming increasingly impossible to actually cash out to real money. Most of these exchanges are moving to Tether only. And one of the interesting things that's happened over the last couple of weeks is a couple of them have forcibly converted to Tether, confiscated all the money you had in it, and gave you dollar peg Tether coins instead.
Who was this?
I believe that was, I saw it on the front page of your subreddit yesterday, the Buttcoin subreddit. Let me pull that up real quick. This was the third link right here. Cobinhood?
I'll have to look that one up.
Yeah, it's the third link on your Buttcoin subreddit.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. All right.
So, yeah, the amount of real money is a good question. I mean, this is never brought up, but like, Coinbase, it's a big thing for British customers, because in the UK they're like the most popular exchange, but they will happily take pounds sterling in and show you a balance in pounds and so on, but you can't withdraw pounds. You can only withdraw euros, and they have to go a circuitous route via their bank in Latvia, and you have assorted fees and delays, and they just make it really, any system where it's so much harder to get money out than it is to get money in has a number of problems.
Yeah,
there should be a lot of red flags for people participating in it.
Yeah, stated reasons for Tether is to get around a lot of the regulation of doing financing in dollars. Like, there's all sorts of rules you have to adhere to. And so they do Tether, and they just don't accept U.S. dollar, and they use this and pretend it's dollars.
Yes. I'm frankly amazed that the Bitcoin market is still pricing these things at $1. It's like, at some point, they're going to not do that, and nobody knows when.
For those who don't know, and this will be our last little bit here, so let me just give a brief overview. But Tether is a cryptocurrency that's supposedly pegged one-to-one for the dollar. Every Tether that Bitfinex, through Tether Limited, they're owned by the same people, releases represents $1 that was deposited into their bank account that they hold on to. This is a little bit crazy because they lost all their bank accounts, and we know this through the Panama Papers, of all things. And then they were able to get one tiny bank account in a tiny Polish bank. And through this, they apparently, if you accept the number of tethers they're printing as legitimate, have taken in $2 billion in U.S. dollars through this tiny-ass Polish bank. So, you know, you do the math on that.
Wow.
Wow. You're fading. So was...
Yeah, you faded there at the end, bro.
Oh, I'm sorry. I think we're going to just about wrap this up then. We've held on to you for nearly 20 minutes here, David. David is the...
One other bit which I need to cover.
Go for it.
Which you'll probably possibly want to mention. The other common Bitcoin argument, what about all the electricity used by the banking system, huh? That's so much bigger. But this is a bad argument because, one, they process stupidly more transactions than Bitcoin could ever manage. And you know, if it costs that much per transaction, you'd see it in the cost of each transaction. And secondly, the Bitcoin in the banking industry, they have a drive to efficiency. You know, they have motivation to make stuff more efficient, not less. Whereas Bitcoin, the more it's used, the less efficient it gets. It's literally anti-efficient, anti-scales.
Ars Technica has a figure up that every Bitcoin transaction done and confirmed represents 250 kilowatt hours of power, enough to power the average home for 9 days.
Yep, that's about right. And that's priced in to each transaction. And that money eventually comes from someone buying Bitcoins, and it goes, trundles through the system in various directions and ends up at the miners who... have to pay their electricity and hardware costs in actual money. So everyone else can be throwing around tethers, but eventually the miners have to pay their costs in actual money.
And that's...
So, yeah. It'll all be interesting.
Yeah. It seems like it's all about to come down at some point between the increasingly erratic tether printer that's, you know, spat out $400 million in the space of just 4 days, and these ridiculously ballooning energy prices that just get higher and higher and higher. 250 kilowatt hours to confirm a single transaction. Imagine paying that every time you swipe your debit card.
It's amazing stuff. Bitcoiners have various proposed solutions to this, but the most important thing about all these solutions is they don't exist and don't work yet.
That's been pretty much the promise of that technology from the beginning. Blockchain is defended by its, you know, supporters as being this hugely impressive thing, but Google Docs is basically the blockchain. You load a distributed database onto a cloud platform, and congratulations, you've just invented the blockchain. It doesn't seem anything that revolutionary about it.
There are no revolutionary bits of the blockchain. All the bits that are good, like we've known about for years or decades and used in practice where they were applicable and they work really well.
And JJ pointed out a fantastic link in our Facebook group about how police are able to look at drug deals from, you know, years and years and years ago on the Silk Road just by tracing back the Bitcoins.
It's awesome. Prosecution futures.
Yeah. It doesn't look like it's easy right now, but I'm sure it's going to get easier as time goes on.
A completely transparent ledger that everybody can see turns out to maybe not be what you want for some things.
Right.
Yeah, they're trying other currencies that are less visible, like Monero, but that sort of does it by obfuscating the transactions. It may or may not be traceable, but it's also not used for anything else, and also it's really hard to trade directly to dollars, like even harder than Bitcoins are. Typically, it'll go Monero to Bitcoins to dollars.
Monero was the one that that Argentina Starbucks got caught using their Wi-Fi landing page to force people to mine in the browsers.
Yeah, that's the one that if malware in adverts or viruses or dodgy extensions in your browser start mining cryptocurrencies, it'll be Monero, because you can still mine those on a CPU with relative efficiency.
Okay. Well, thank you for joining us and taking a bit out of your night, David. David is the author of Attack of the 50-Foot Blockchain, Bitcoin, Ethereum, and Smart Contracts. We really appreciate you stopping by, and have a great night, David.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you much.
All right.